Welcome to your commercial-free, uninterrupted investment show, sponsored by the SEC-registered investment firm, Wilsey Asset Management, a fiduciary firm owned and operated by President Brent Wilsey, who has been putting clients' investment needs first for over 40 years. The Smart Investing Show has been giving unbiased financial information for over 27 years on local radio stations right here in San Diego, providing you with fundamental analysis on stocks and investments you want to know about. Now, here are your hosts, Brent and Chase Wilsey.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Smart Investing Show. I'm Brent Wilsey, president of Wilsey Asset Management. Great to have you here for another edition of the Smart Investing Show. We learn a lot of different things. We talk about what's going on in the economy. We talk about investing, all these things to make you a smarter investor and I think a smarter person as well. Today, we're going to cover retail sales came out, and they were pretty hot. We'll talk about that. Going to talk about value companies, and people really miss investing, not understanding the value of something. We're going to go over pretty good detail on what we talk about and kind of give an example of that. And also, too, homeowners insurance. I mean, insurance companies are doing very well, but people, insurance companies are so mean, they're doing this. We'll kind of talk about how maybe they're not so mean, and again, they're a business, so keep that in mind. With me is Chase. Chase, what do you got?
Well, got a lot here as well. Going to take a look at some good companies here. Going to look at KB Homes. You know, the real estate market, we know the inventory has been extremely tight. It's been a huge benefactor for these home builders. So we're going to take a close look at KB Homes. We're going to look at Northrop Grumman. No secret here. There's a lot of, turmoil across the world right now. What does that mean for defense companies? Are they a potential buy at this time? And then also, too, we have two companies here. We recommended staying away earlier this year. Boeing and Tesla both have fallen quite dramatically. I mean, I don't know, maybe with the falls, are they worth it at this point? Is that value part finally crept into these stocks? We'll take a closer look.
Well, let's jump right into retail sales because people may be complaining about higher interest rates, but it does not appear to be slowing down the consumer. Retail sales climbed 0.7% in the month of March, which is easily topped the estimate of 0.3%. Now, compared to last year, sales were up an impressive 4%. Areas of strength continue to be non-store retailers, which were up 11.3% compared to last year, and food services and drinking places, which were up 6.5% over the same time period. Areas that continue to weigh on the report were furniture and home furnishings. They were down 6.1%. Electronics and appliance stores fell by 0.6%, and building material and garden equipment and supplies dealers, well, they were down about 0.6%.
You know, it's interesting. The last two, I mean, home furnishings is still struggling quite a bit, but, you know, all three of those, again, were kind of COVID losers, essentially, because they were big boomers during COVID and post-COVID. I think everybody kind of bought everything they needed, so things really slowed down. It looks like those are finally maybe starting to kind of hit the bottom, and maybe we'll start to see growth in those areas. And also, too, I was kind of surprised the food services and drinking places, I mean, they're still up 6.5%, as you said, but definitely slowed down a little bit from where we were seeing. I mean, we were seeing months where it was up double digits, so interesting stuff there.
And kind of interrupt here a little bit, but what we generally do is we compare generally to 2019. That was more of a normal economy. Some of these numbers are kind of screwed because of the fact that they're based on COVID. And during COVID, there was that staying at home thing. So people are buying furnishings and, you know, home products and stuff like that, electronics. Well, now they've gotten all they need. Of course they're going
to
be down.
Well, it's hard. You can't compare to 2019 on everything because now we're 5 years later and you better see growth five years later. So, I mean, you got to have that mix. It's still a sticking point, but again, you got to understand the variability that came about. But also, too, want to talk about that while energy prices have increased lately and gas stations did see an increase of 2.1% compared to February, compared to last year, sales were actually still down 0.7%. And I bring this up because it makes a point that retail sales, that headline number was even more impressive considering the fact that if gas stations were excluded from the headline number, it would have been up 4.4% compared to last year. So people are spending. And I said it before, but again, overall, this report provides further proof that the consumer, well, they remain resilient. And this could bring into question the number of rate cut that we do see this year. If the consumer remains strong, we may only see one or two cuts this year. I know some have speculated maybe no cuts.
Yeah, and this did change the direction and it caused the market a little bit of turmoil because, oh, you know, the Fed may not be cutting. Even Jerome Powell came out, the Federal Reserve Chairman, said, yeah, we're going to be a little more patient here. But the number that comes out next Friday is the PCE, which is, I think, is going to look better, and I think we'll see a reversal. The 10-year Treasury, I think, hit 4.6% this past week.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it definitely spiked up pretty substantially there. I'm trying to see if I can pull it up real quick where it's at currently. But
Well, it was down a little bit on Friday, but I know that it did spike up, and it kind of worried things. And we do have what we call an interest rate sensitive portfolio because of the financials and real estate the portfolio, which kind of hurt that. But on Friday, we did extremely well compared to the indexes, which fell quite a bit on Friday. I think the S&P was down like 0.9 or 0.88. And I think the NASDAQ fell 2% on Friday. Tech just got hammered.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it definitely did. And right now, the 10-year Treasury, it's about 4.61%. I forgot this last year. Gosh,
it was 5.4, didn't it, last year?
Not 5.4. The high on it was 4.99.
I thought that at one point it did pass the 5% range on the 10-year Treasury. No, not showing.
I'm using Apple here, okay. So unless Apple's lying.
Well, Apple's having problems too, so maybe.
But I just think again that the rate cuts, they're still possible. And Jeremy Siegel, who works with the Wharton Business School there, School of Business, Wharton School of Business, definitely respected market commentator. I mean, he was talking about how you could still see rate cuts because the fact that this 5%, 5.3% level is still considered potentially overly restrictive. And their long-term goal is around, I think, 2.3% or something on the Fed funds rate. And Jeremy Siegel said, I still think it's higher than that. But let's say I have a restrictive or a good policy of on the Fed's funds rate of 3%. We're still over it by 2.3%. You cut maybe three times, that's 75 basis points. You're still well above the long-term goal of, you know, their goal of 2.3 and maybe Jeremy Siegel's goal of around 3%. So rates are still restrictive. You could potentially, I guess, see 1, 2, 3 rate cuts as long as I think PCE remains strong. The economy could be hot, but if inflation cools, that's where I think you could still get 1, 2, maybe 3 rate cuts.
Yeah, and again, we talked about that retail sales. Consumers stop their spending because they've got those jobs. And we've talked about this, I think, over past weeks. We really don't need a rate cut if the companies are still making money and they're increasing their earnings and increasing sales. We really don't need it. The market wants it. But if a business is doing fine, they increase their earnings year over year by 4 or 5%, like, well, we don't really need that rate cut.
Yeah, well, you don't need it. But also, too, you want to make sure that they're not overly restrictive. And then all of a sudden we do catapult into a recession because we don't want to look at earnings growth in the past because it's not always an indicator of what's great going forward. So, you know, I think it again is a very hard line for the Fed to walk here. But I think it really hinges on inflation. That the best case scenario we get is inflation comes down, economy remains strong, and then maybe we do get those three rate cuts. I think that would be the best overall situation for stock returns as we exit 2024. I mean, that's a what we'll call a Goldilocks, a perfect situation there.
Yeah. So let's talk about value companies because we have been value investors for many, many years going back to, well, back in the early 90s. With the market's recent highs, we have a few companies that reached their target sell price. We sold those companies and now we're sitting on a large amount of cash. We were considering investing into an oil and or natural gas company because based on the valuations, they are still not expensive. One thing that has concerned me and concerned us is that we are probably near the peak for gasoline consumption, but oil is also used in chemicals with a big demand coming from plastics. Now, approximately 102 million barrels of oil are produced every day, and roughly 60 million barrels go to diesel, gasoline, and jet fuel. Only 12 million of that ends up in chemicals. What concerned us even more is how all the oil companies like Chevron, Shell, and Saudi Aramco have a big push to produce more for chemicals. For instance, Shell opened a chemical complex with a capacity to produce 1.6 million tons of plastic pellets per year.
Saudi Aramco is also working on turning 4 million barrels of crude oil per day into chemicals by the year 2030. Today, just 1 million barrels go into chemicals. For many years, China has been a major consumer of plastic, and they accounted for 70% of plastic demand. I mean, that number just blew me away. But also, too, I guess not really when you think about the amount of manufacturing China
right,
does.
That's true.
Now that they are producing their own plastic capacity, though, it is actually exceeding demand. That could be a big problem. On top of all this, you have the push for recycling plastics, and statistics show that only 10% or less of plastic actually gets recycled. Even a doubling of that over the next few years would mean less oil needed for plastics. Now, recycled plastics are roughly 50% more expensive than virgin plastic, but I believe that will come down in future years, of course, as efficiencies and processes improve. Now, in summary, at this point, it does not make any sense that I can see to invest in an oil company or also to the chemical companies. I mean, we talked about maybe looking at chemical
yeah.
companies, but this could be a huge problem for them if plastic is a major part of their business. You got to understand that. It may look like they could be on sale, but with the large supply going forward, sales and earnings, well, they could actually decline, which would then mean they are currently fully priced. The abundance of plastics is estimated to go on until the year 2030. So, long story short here, the search for that great value company to add to our portfolio, well, it continues.
And Chase, we spent a little more time on this than usual, but I want people to understand that, and we always talk about, before we invest in any company, it's 10, 15, 20 hours of research to really understand what's going on. That gives you an example of the different things we're looking at, questioning, you know, the good side, the bad side, really trying to understand what is going on with that business. And before you buy it, we've been kind of looking at doing this for quite a while, and we keep getting more and more research, and then we realize, well, wait a minute here, there is going to be problems. And what we thought about the use of chemicals, well, that's not going to be enough consumption of oil, and then the recycle. I mean, there's so many things you get into buying and investing in. We call them equities. People call them stocks. And it's amazing to me where someone will buy a stock virtually based on a one-page article they read or something else.
One-page article? That's generous. I was going to say a five-word headline.
Right. Or something they heard on CNBC. Or I always used to use my brother-in-law said this is a great one. And it's just like, and they do very little research.
Sometimes it works out. They get lucky. But I'd say most of the time they don't.
Yeah, well, most of the time they don't. Everybody, what's the saying? Even a blind squirrel gets a nut once in a while. And it's just something that, you know, you will have the winner. Same thing, go to Vegas. There's times you win in Vegas, but overall you don't. And when you're investing for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, your lifetime, I mean, you know, investing is something that you do for your entire life, because you never have to say, well, I don't need more money. No, you always need that, especially when you get older. So it's something you have to spend the time on to really understand. And when we invest in a equity, a company, a stock, we're saying, where will this be 3 to 5 years from now? Not 3 to 5 minutes. And I remember Warren Buffett saying was, if it can't hold the stock for 5 years, don't buy it for 5 minutes.
Yeah, and I forget his other saying, but it was something along the lines of, you know, investing's a zero strike game.
Yep.
You know, you don't have to swing at everything that comes your way. I mean, and the truth of the matter is, yeah, you're going to miss a great pitch every once in a while. And, you know, you could miss that equity that does go up and it's like, shoot, missed it.
Yep.
But again,
yep.
You don't want to swing or something and strike out. You want to be patient, make sure you get good things in the portfolio. And even with that, you might swing at a good pitch and you might hit a fly ball.
Yeah.
That goes, it's an out. You know, you got to be understanding that investing isn't always perfect. And frankly, you will make mistakes. You will invest in companies that go lower. I mean, we always tell people we're wrong a third of the time. But again, if you're right 2/3, you can do well investing.
Yeah. But we have many stories. I don't think we can say this on air, but we'll tell it to people when they come in for a consultation. Is that, you know, we'll buy things. They will go down 20-30%. But throughout my years of doing this, there's been times that we've had companies down 30-40-50-60%. And we continue to hold that company. What are you doing? Why did you sell it? Because of it's because of the fact that it had the fundamentals, it had the earnings. And then when you look at the long term, now that has passed, like, wow, we did extremely well. We made 600, 700, 800%, whatever it may be. That's how Warren Buffett's done so well, by holding companies long term. And this is why we do our numbers every single Monday, not because something's going to change, but to keep us on track to make sure nothing did change.
Yeah.
So
it's, and be very clear, we're not saying we did 700%. We're right. saying, hey, you could have done 700% if you held
yeah.
the right thing.
And those were not what we actually did. Those are just examples of, you know, things that can happen over the long term.
And I would yeah. just tell people as well, I mean, you have to understand is if you buy something that goes down, the biggest mistake people make is now they're looking at what they paid for it. But we always tell people the market doesn't know what you paid for that stock you bought.
Right.
You have to look at that moment in time. Does it make sense to still hold that company? Because let's say it doesn't even get back to what you paid for it. Over that next year, 2 year period, let's say that stock you had that fell 50% now goes up, I'm going to say 70% from where it's at. Yeah, it's not back to what you paid for it, but you would have then had to find something else that did better than a 70% gain over that time period.
Yep.
That's why sticking to the numbers enables us to, again, kind of remove that emotional component and looking at saying, you know, we still got a good business and, you know, we want to look at where we're at today and where we'll be 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road.
Exactly. Well, let's move on and talk about homeowners insurance because it's been in the news quite a bit, I'd say, over the last probably 6 months. You hear and read that insurance companies are dropping homeowners for no reason. Well, it turns out that insurance companies are becoming wiser in how to verify that policy owners are following the rules. To keep costs and risk down, insurance companies are now using drones, satellites, and airplanes to take aerial photos of your house. If you neglected to tell the insurance company that you have a pool, trampoline, a roof in bad shape, or yard debris and hanging tree branches that are fire hazards, well, these will show up in those aerial views.
Now, you may think this is unfair, but when you sign your policy, you agree to home visits to verify that you're telling the truth. Another question for consumers is it fair for you to pay the same insurance premium with a brand new roof than your next door neighbor whose roof is maybe 25 years old? At first thought, it seems unfair that insurance companies can take pictures of your home from the sky, but if you neglected to tell them the truth about that pool or trampoline, maybe they have the right to drop you. In the long run, this could help insurance companies keep premiums lower for those who follow the rules and disclose to the insurance companies all the insurable risks that they have.
And it's just such a shame. I mean, and again, insurance companies are a business. They do have to make profits. And I'm sorry about that dirty word of business making a profit, but that's why they're there. And if you lie to that company, they have the right to cancel you or raise your premiums because it's just not fair. And if you're car insurance, yeah. If you're a bad driver, why should you pay the same insurance premium that a good driver is paying that's ever had an accident?
Yeah, I know. There's that. I've been wanting to look at it, but frankly, I got my insurance the other day, and it wasn't that bad, and I was like, I'm okay. I'll just stick with it. But I've been hearing more and more about the kind of, I think they call it the telematics, where they kind of track your driving, and I'm like, if it would save me maybe $50 a month, I would definitely consider doing that and change a little bit how I drive. But, you know, if it saved me money, I'd consider doing something like that. But the point is, it's like if you're doing the right things, yeah, you should be able to pay a lower rate. But if you're lying about it, it's like, yeah, I'm a great driver. I never speed. And you're over here on the freeway going 90 miles an hour. It's like, yeah, that is not fair. You're lying. And that causes a lot of problems. And frankly, it's things like that where people lie about it. And then all of a sudden the insurance company has to pay out more. That costs everybody else in terms of the premiums they're paying.
Yep.
So you want to talk about unfair, you lying is unfair. And that's why, you know, I think it is a fair thing that they're doing here to ensure that they can actually have profitable premiums. And again, people might not like that word profitable premiums, but if you don't like it, hey, maybe buy an insurance company in your portfolio.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that we like insurance companies.
I will tell you, I mean, you look back long term, insurance companies are one of the best businesses to buy just because of the fact that, you know, when things come and you know, natural disasters hit, well, generally those premiums increase and long term premiums increase over time. And I'll tell you, as a consumer, sometimes, yeah, it's not fair, but if you're not happy with it, well, join them. You know, nobody's stopping you from buying the stock.
And one thing, too, we look at, you know, we don't invest in AI, but we look for companies that benefit from AI. I think insurance companies have a major benefit with AI down the road. I think it's going to make their risk much better what they're seeing.
And I will tell you as well, you want profitable insurance companies because the worst thing that can happen is you have an unprofitable insurance company. That's where you have a policy. They go bankrupt. Your house burns down. Something happens to it. Now that insurance company's gone, you're screwed. You want good insurance companies because they need to be there for you when those troubling times come so you can get the payouts and benefit from all the premiums that you did pay.
Yep. So insurance companies, they're not bad businesses, but, you know.
They're great businesses for investing in.
For investing, but also, too, for people. If you tell the truth, you're fine. These all come from our newsletter that goes out every Friday at 5 o'clock. Other articles in the newsletter that you might like, too. And keep in mind, you don't have to read the whole newsletter. You can pull out different things. We also talk in the newsletter about the service fees, copper price, U.S. Postal Service, got some good things there we talked about, investing in Bitcoin, real estate investors, entrepreneur ideas, and the Chinese government. I was shocked when I saw this. I'll just kind of tease you on this real quick. Do you know in China, you cannot file bankruptcy? That debt you have is with you for the rest of your life. And they can avoid, and this is what I tell people, China is not, they're a communist country. China can make it so you can no longer take a vacation. You cannot ride a high-speed rail. You cannot check into a luxury hotel. That country is run by the government. So do not think that China is anything like the United States. Can you imagine if somebody said, well, no, you can't take a vacation? Yeah. The government told you that?
Oh, I have too much student debt and I can't pay it. Oh, sorry. You're not doing anything. You're paying us back. Oh, people would love that.
I know. So China is not like the U.S. So just remember that when you're investing. All right. Again, that can be that news that is at our website, smartinvesting2000.com. That's smartinvesting2000.com. Right in the middle page, just click on it. You'll get the free newsletter every Friday at 5 o'clock. And you can also read past newsletters as well. So again, smartinvesting2000.com. Well, it's time to talk to our financial planner, our CFP, Harrison Johnson. Harrison, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, guys. How are you doing?
Good, good. So we're talking about avoiding Social Security reductions caused by pensions. Well, that doesn't sound like a good thing. I thought your Social Security was locked in.
So if you receive a pension from work that was not covered by Social Security, you may see a reduction in any Social Security benefits you're entitled to, which would include benefits on your own earnings history or any spousal benefits that you might be claiming. So even though you're getting a Social Security statement in the mail, that doesn't know about your pension, and so the actual amount you get when you go to apply could be less than that amount on there. This is caused by something called the windfall elimination provision or the government pension offset, depending on what type of benefit you're collecting for. But keep in mind, if you earn a pension from a job where you did pay into Social Security, you won't have any problems or any reductions. So that might include military retirement or the federal employment retirement system, or if you have a pension from a defense contractor, you still see those. You don't have any reductions with that. But one of the common pension systems we see in California is CalSTRS for teachers. So teachers do not pay into Social Security, so their pensions will reduce any Social Security amount that they would get. But one way of getting around this is by taking what's called a refund from your pension. So this allows you to withdraw all of your contributions plus your interest from the pension and then roll that into your own retirement account so then you can invest it however you want, and then you will not have any reduction to any Social Security you might be entitled to, which again could be spousal benefits that you're going to claim off your spouse. The reason you can do this is because when you take a refund from that CalSTRS pension, it only includes your own contributions, not contributions made by the employer. So if there's other pensions where if you take the lump sum option, which also includes the employer contributions, you'll still see a reduction on your Social Security amount. Now, taking a refund from CalSTRS is not appropriate for everybody. If you're somebody who's close to retirement or you've been a part of that CalSTRS system for a long time, most likely it'll make sense to stay with that, get your pension, even if that means that you'll have a reduced Social Security amount. However, if you're somebody who's younger or you have limited earnings history with CalSTRS or you're entitled to get a large Social Security benefit or spousal benefit or survivor benefit or something like that, then rolling over your CalSTRS pension to a retirement account may make sense, so you get the benefit of the Social Security full amount, and also you can have your CalSTRS pension dollars. So something to think about, a little bit technical, but there are cases where, you know, you can kind of have your cake and eat it too, so to speak.
And Harrison, this is why I say it's so important to have a separate money manager managing your portfolio and a separate CFP, financial planner, doing your planning for you. There are so many things that one person just cannot remember. I mean, because normally you look at saying, okay, if I'm not a financial planner, like, okay, we're going to get this dollar amount from your pension from CalSTRS, that sounds pretty good. We'll go that direction. Not realizing that if you rolled it over, perhaps you could have been better because you would have got Social Security. I mean, there's so many things to look at it, and that's why when I see people going to your office main time for their initial consultation, you're there for a long time because there's so many things to cover.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different things to cover, like you said. And, you know, in cases like this, I usually see it where maybe you have one spouse who works in the private sector, and then you have another spouse who's a teacher. And, you know, the teacher, since they're not paying into Social Security, they don't have any benefits of their own, but they could collect a spousal benefit, but because of their pension, they wouldn't get anything. Well, this would allow you to, again, get the dollars that you've put into that pension and then still collect a Social Security spousal benefit in addition to the Social Security your spouse gets. So you kind of get more things going on, which, you know, is better for the overall situation. So again, this is, you know, kind of a technical thing. There are people that this can benefit, but, you know, this is one of many things that, you know, is something that you want to look at.
Just a quick question for you, Harrison. So obviously I know with teachers, they can pay into CalSTRS or CalPERS. If they pay into CalPERS, are they paying into Social Security there or no?
It depends. The reason I didn't bring that up is because there are some parts of CalPERS where you do pay into Social Security, so then it's not a problem. But there's other people who pay into CalPERS and they don't pay into Social Security. So that's another case where any pension that you contribute to that's not part of Social Security can fit this. CalSTRS is one of the common ones. CalPERS could be another. If you're a firefighter, if you're a cop, you don't pay into Social Security. So, you know, there are cases where if you can withdraw the money that you've contributed alone, that means you would then be eligible for Social Security, like from your spouse. So it depends on the earnings. But, you know, CalSTRS is just one of the common ones. But there's other ones that it could be applicable for.
I would just say it's so funny. Not funny, but it's very interesting. I mean, Harrison and I both, our wives worked slash work in the education system. And I just got to tell you, they have one of the most complicated retirement situations because you have CalPERS, CalSTRS, 403Bs, 457. I mean, you got so many choices.
It's true.
I don't think they get educated at all on any of them. And I think it's a disservice. I mean, it's like, gosh, as much as sometimes I question the TSP, it's like, just go with the TSP because at least it's easy. This is complicated for most people.
Yeah. And this is why you need a good financial planner, because I spend all my time, Chase spends all his time, you know, analyzing investments and so forth. Harrison, you spend all your time analyzing regulations and rules and distributions, things of this nature, to understand all these different scenarios that people run across.
Yeah, and it doesn't sound very fun when you put it that way, but that is what I do, because, again, the end result is if you can find a way to reduce your taxes or, you know, come out with more money or have some type of benefit, that's the stuff that I think is exciting. And there's a whole bunch of little loopholes and little tricks and things that you can do. And again, that's what I focus on.
Yeah. And you know, people think we're crazy. We look at financial statements. We think they're exciting. What you do, you think is exciting. That's what we do. That's what we love. So, Harrison, thank you very much. We will see you on Monday.
All right. Thanks, guys. See you Monday.
All righty. Well, there's the break music. We got to take a break here. Again, if you want to sit down with Harrison and a free financial plan analysis to see if it makes sense for you, give him a call at the office, 858-224-0004. Again, that's 858-224-0004, or go to the website smartinvesting2000.com.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars.
All righty. Welcome back to the second half of the Smart Investing Show. This is where we talk about the individual equities, the companies. And you learn a lot about this, not just about investing, but about the businesses as well. And you also learn what we do, value investing. And when we pick out these companies, we don't pre-look at what we're going to see. We pick out the companies based on what we think people like to hear about, something in the news, and then we break them down for you live right here on air. So first one we talked about it in real estate is KB Homes. Now, their symbol is KBH. They're in the residential construction industry. I'm surprised on this. They have a 9.8% float on the short side. That means almost 10% of the people are shorting the stock. That's pretty high. We do see that they have not reported earnings yet. That'll probably come out another month or so. But their PE ratio still looks pretty good, what you're paying for the earnings, 8.3 versus 10.9. Price to sales, 0.8 versus 1.1. Price to book value, 1.2 versus 1.3. And price to cash flow, 4.9 versus 13.4. Those are all pretty good valuation ratios. Now, the PEG ratio, what you're paying for the future growth, also is very good for KB Homes, 0.7 versus 1.6. The lower that number, the better there. So looking at the growth of the company, we do see over the last year, earnings are down 19.1%, industry down 4.1%. That's not good. Sales for KB Homes fell by 5.7%, industry up 4.1%. What's going on here with this company? The analysts going forward in the next 5 years, they're seeing growth of 11.1%. That is above the industry at 2.7%. Now, you get a 1.3% dividend from KB Homes. They only use 10% of their earnings to pay that out. We do see on the balance sheet how strong this company. Current ratio 5.7 versus 9.1. And with real estate companies, it's a little bit different financial numbers, how you do it. So that sounds high, but it's norm for a real estate company. And then we do see debt to equity is 0.4 versus 0.3. That is a positive. Looking at the net profit margin, 9.3% for KB Homes versus 10.2 for the industry. Return on equity looking okay at 15.4. versus 17.9. Chase, what do you got?
Yeah, so current price here for KB Home, again, their ticker symbol is KBH. It's $61.03. 52-week range here, the low $40.97 and the high here $72. I see year-to-date the stock's down about 2%, but over the last year, the stock looks like to be up about close to 50%. I did see in the news, it looks like the company announced a $1 billion stock buyback, and that's very important because their market cap here is $4.59 billion. I mean, that's a huge buyback in terms of the percentage of the market cap.
And I got to say, I hope they did it like GM. GM announced that, and they did it very quickly. Sometimes these companies announce a buyback, and they do it over a long period of time. So you want to watch this very closely if they're going to do that $1 billion very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, if they do it quickly, that'd be a huge boost to earnings per share because the share count would reduce quite drastically. But yeah, you're right. If they do it over 3 years, it's not as exciting as even over the next year. I mean, you buy back, we'll call it 20-25% of your shares outstanding within a one-year time period. That's pretty drastic. So definitely interesting there. But going forward, I go out to November 2025. This company appears to report on a fiscal basis. I see estimated earnings per share of $8.52. I mean, it gives a target sell price of $141.43. So again, well above the current price of $61.03. I mean, the numbers look very good on it. I will say, though, I am a little bit nervous just about the home building industry. It's done so well. Can it continue? That's my big question. And I don't know if you'll get to a normalized multiple on those earnings just because of the cyclical nature of the home building business.
And one thing I want to point out to people is that home builders have changed the way they do business to help them through the lean times. What I'm talking about is that years ago, 10 years ago, they would buy all that land and try to build on it. If a slowdown came during that time frame, they got hammered because they owned all that real estate, went down in value. What many of the builders are doing now, they're buying options to purchase that land. So if things do reverse and slow down, well, they don't have to worry about that because they won't exercise the option. So make sure when you look at KB Home or any home builder, do they own a lot of land? Are they doing the options on it? What are they doing? Because, you know, we do see rates are higher. I think that the mortgage rates are past 7%. I think that will come down and doesn't do well this year, maybe next year. But keep in mind, when you're buying this business, a home builder, you're looking down the road long term. How do they get that land that they build on?
Yeah, and I mean, the big thing that it appears to be happening is back, you know, kind of during the financial crisis, they had overexpanded way too much. And I think a lot of home builders had learned their lesson. And fortunately, unfortunately, I mean, if you hold these stocks, it's been a great benefit. But unfortunately, it hasn't brought as much supply onto the market, which would then help with the affordability of homes. They've kind of kept their building in check, which has, again, reduced the amount of potential supply. And I mean, we know inventory is extremely tight. I think I did see the existing home sales inventory was up like 14% over last year, but still, compared to pre-pandemic levels, I mean, it's a very tight real estate market.
You know, another thing we look at here is days inventory. We don't do it on the air very often. We do it when we're buying companies. It does show 374.3 days, which is above the industry at 325. So you want that number lower, not higher. It means that their inventory is longer on an inventory. It takes them longer to collect on that. So
yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Yeah. Obviously, it's a home. It's not a, you know, a cheeseburger.
But compared to the industry, so that's what you look at.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to say I don't want to give credence to that number, but I'd want to understand the story behind it because it could be reasons on how their sales pipeline works. But I don't know. I mean, I want to say yeah, but it's kind of like the energy market because the numbers look good, but I don't know if I'd want to be in this market.
And Jason, what I was pointing out is like early in the show we talked about, it's something that it causes you a question. Say, wait a minute, what is that? I'm not saying you shouldn't do it because of that, but you want to understand what is going on there. Do they have a problem with their inventory? The other thing too I want to point out as well was I believe why the current ratio is so high, I believe that includes, and correct me if I'm wrong, their deposits that they bring in, or there's some reason why the current ratio is so high on builders. Remember?
You know, it's very strange because we held a home builder previously, and it's been a little bit of time, so I don't recall, but the balance sheet was just strange. It had like almost a bunch of assets lumped in as current assets. So, I mean, you just got to kind of go through the balance sheet and understand it, understand what's counted as current assets versus current liabilities. It's more complicated than just a traditional company. But I wasn't saying doubting your inventory thing. I was just saying overall, I think, you know, the numbers look great, but I don't think I would want to be buying in the home building industry is kind of the point I was trying to make.
Right. And we bring up these things as, you know, things to look at. And it's one thing, too, if you hold this and you have another broker or advisor and they hold it, you got to ask them these questions. If they don't know the answers to those questions, you could be have somebody that's taking guesses and not really analyzing the investments in your portfolio. So, well let's move on because obviously the world, there's some major turmoil going on, I'll put it that way. And so we're looking at a defense contractor because obviously there's, you know, we have the dome and was it Israel and you got Iran. I mean, all these bombs going to place. You got
Russia, Ukraine still going on.
So we thought, well, let's take a look at a company that deals in the military, the defense contracting side. And for that, we pulled out Northrop Grumman. And I think you said they're right here in San Diego.
I believe I see their buildings all the time. They
may not be stationed here, maybe, but they do have building, and people probably do work for them. But
yeah, it looks like they're headquartered in Virginia.
Virginia, yeah, it makes sense.
They must have a headquarters here or something.
So, but they're in the aerospace and defense industry. We do see short on the float there, only 1.3%. Institutional owned is 85.1%. Unfortunately, well, not surprised, but the high P/E ratio of 34.2, I think they will find because of what's going on with Ukraine, and I can't believe that's been going on, I think, for 3 years now, that Ukraine and Russia war.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so, but this is one that does well during, obviously, wartime periods. Price of sales, 1.8 versus 1.6. Price to book value, 4.6 versus 4.7. Price of cash flow checks in at 18.1. That is slightly better than the industry at 20.7. And the pay ratio for Northrop Grumman is only 0.6 versus 1.9. Now, we do see their earnings over the last year. This is a surprise, down 56.2% versus 10.1% positive for the industry. This is where, again, you want to check in to see, did they take some write-offs? What happened? Or was the previous year their earnings so high that this year that they're so low? Did they sell a building? You got to know the answer to these questions before you invest in the company. Sales, they were up 5.9%, better than the industry, down 5%. And the five-year earnings growth rate, wow, 29.4 for Northrop Grumman, but it's 30.2% for the industry. So it looks like the defense contractors should be doing well over the next 5 years. They do pay a 1.6% dividend. They use 54% of their earnings to pay that out. And then look at the balance sheet for Northrop Grumman. We do see that the current ratio is 1.2. That is slightly below the industry at 1.5. Debt to equity, 1.1 versus 0.8. I'm okay with that. Net profit margin checks in at 5.2, the same as the industry. And return on equity, 13.9 for Northrop Grumman. That's below the industry at 16.7. So I'm not really that thrilled in Northrop Grumman unless you can change my mind on things going forward.
I was just going to say real quickly, too, on the defense companies, it's always interesting because you think that their sales would spike during difficult time periods. But I do recall when we had, you know, a defense company in our portfolio that sometimes after the kind of troubles dissipate, their sales actually do better because everybody has to replenish the stocks that were depleted during the wartime. So, you know, I'm not advocating for, you know, difficult time periods like this. But, you know, you could see a run rate here over the next several years for these defense companies to still see sales and earnings growth as, you know, certain countries, militaries replenish the systems that were lost during these kind of battles. Looking at the current price here for Northrop Grumman, though, $462.58, 52-week range, $414.56 is the low. The high here, $496.89. I see over the last 1 year, stocks about down 3%. Year to date, down about 1%. So hasn't really done much as of late. Going forward, though, I go out to December 2025. I see estimated earnings per share here, $27.59. Gives us a target sell price of $457.99. So pretty much right at that current price of $462. I'd have to say this company is essentially fully valued at this point. It's not egregiously overpriced. It's not underpriced. It's I'd say fairly priced, which...
Yeah, and it's not surprising. I mean, being in this area now with the number of military actions going on, that you would see this pretty much fully priced, but you might be thinking, oh, time to get into it. As Chase just said, it's pretty much fully valued. You want to find something to invest in before everybody else knows about it, before they get into it. But we just thought it'd be a good time to kind of look at that. And and you don't even collect a good dividend. What's the dividend? 1.3%, I think I said.
1.65 is 1.65. What I show on the forward yield.
Yeah, yeah. So Northrop Grumman, at best, we'd give it a hold.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, let's change gears a little bit. Let's talk about real estate. And for that, we turn to our real estate expert, Robert Behick from Countywide Mortgage Lending. He is president of Countywide Mortgage Lending. Robert, how you doing today?
Fantastic. Good morning.
Well, I like the topic today, and I want you to kind of explain a little bit, because today we're talking about when is a good time to buy down your interest rate when purchasing or refinancing. Can you first explain what it means to buy down your interest rate?
Certainly. Absolutely. And to preface that, the KB, they're a great company, but I would tell you that the thing that was sort of really important in that is, where are they in their build cycle, the construction part, because that's where everybody gets paid.
Good
but
point.
moving into when should you buy down your rate? What does that mean? It means you pay points. Points can be 1% of your loan amount, and you spend that money to get a lower interest rate. So I have a lot of folks that say, hey, I got this great rate, and what are they charging for it? Well, they want 2 points. And I'm like, well, let's look at the math. And this is one of the things that we do at our firm every day, is we run through the numbers to see if it's worthwhile to spend your money. yeah, it's crazy. So I'll give you a for instance. Here's $1 million loan. And if you were to pay 1 point to get a lower interest rate, that's $10,000. Well, the person's example that they shared with me is that they were getting an interest rate that was 0.25% cheaper. Okay, so we figured out the math. It was $167 a month versus $10,000. So their break even was almost 5 years, 59 months, a little over 59 months. It's like, no, guys, this isn't worth your money. If you can't recoup your costs in 36 months or less, we say, no, step away. Don't spend your money.
Well, because especially when you think about it, I mean, within the next 5 years, I'm still optimistic over the next 5 years, we'll see lower rates. So especially in a period like this, correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, but you wouldn't want to buy down the rate if rates are going to drop and you could refinance.
Well, and so we give you that option. We tell folks, look, we don't exactly what you're saying is that we think you'll be able to get that interest rate without spending anything in the future.
Yeah.
But some folks, just because they want to see that lower rate right now, you know, guys are macho and we want to keep up with each other. And so they sometimes will do it. And it's unfortunate.
And let me take the other side of the argument against you two there, because, and first of all, there is some tax benefits with those points. Don't you get the write off up front or no?
You do.
Okay. So then, I don't know if you included that $165 a month with taxes or not, you know, because that's another factor. But I have heard too is that, well, yeah, depending on how long you're staying at home, I think in your example it's 5 year break even. People might say, you know what, I'm getting a small tax deduction for the paying for the points. You know, I'm going to raise my family this house. We're going to be here for 20 years. I just want to go ahead and put that up front. Does that make any sense? Or, you know, and then if rates do go up and we're all wrong here, we all think rates are going down. If we're all wrong and rates go up over 5 years, like, doggone it. Wish I didn't listen to those guys on smart investing. I should have bought down my rate.
You're absolutely right. I just can tell you, been doing this for 35 plus years and seen these cycles. We're due for rates to come back down. They're too tight right now, but inflation is up, and until that settles down, they're not going to bring rates down.
And Robert, you don't tell people, do this, do that. You give them the reasons on why to do it and what you're thinking, and let that person make their decisions based on good information you gave them.
We like to give options. Here's the reasons why, and then they tell us. It's their loan. It's their home that they're going to be in for a while, as you were suggesting. But you know what? That doesn't mean that the loan has to be there for that long.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of times we will see these loans turn after 2 or 3 years, quite often, actually.
And one thing, too, that I think is important about this conversation is, you know, we talk about how people shop rates all the time is, you know, well, what can you get me on the rate? Well, again, if you were buying down the points, it's not a fair comparison if you're looking at different mortgage people, because one guy's paying down the rate and, you know, he spent $10,000. Of course, you better be getting a lower rate than if you're not buying down the points there.
Well, and they don't necessarily know exactly what their credit score is, because their mortgage credit report's different than a car credit report versus a credit card credit report. Those algorithms are all different. Yeah, so they're guessing, right? They're hoping this is what it is. And many times it doesn't pan out the way they want to, unfortunately. And that's why we rather just tell it straight up front and give them numbers and then let them go. Go shop.
And I'm sure that you do, you know, as you say, you have conversations with people. You've been in the industry for a long time. I'm sure you've seen other mortgage brokers. They just want to make that quick sale and say, yeah, here's the rate. Let's do it. And they just move on to the next person.
And I'm what's called a mortgage banker. So mortgage brokers actually send their loans to me. It is a different animal.
Okay. Well, Robert, well, thank you very much. That was very informative. And we appreciate you being with us today. And we will talk to you next week.
Have a great day, guys.
Okay, Robert. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Again, that's Robert Behick. He is the president of Countywide Mortgage Lending. They are one of the top 100 mortgage companies in America since 2012. If you want to contact Robert directly on a cell phone, give him a call at 760-443-3821. Again, that's 760-443-3821 to have that private conversation with Robert. If you want to go to the website, it's countywidemtg.com. Again, that's countywidemtg.com.
And as a reminder here, Countywide Mortgage Lending is a division of Golden Empire Mortgage, Inc., NMLS number 1104585, licensed by the Department of Financial Protection and Innovation under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. Countywide Mortgage Lending is an equal housing lender and proud member of the BBB.
All right, let's go back to looking at the businesses here, the companies, the equities. And Chase, we talked about Boeing. The first part of the year. And we want to revisit that because it's had some major changes to it. So it has been the news lately, some things going on with Boeing. We want to kind of re-look at this to see, because it was high at the time. And let's see if now with what's going on with Boeing, if it makes sense now after the fall it's had. I think Chase will give us the fall, how much it's fallen. If it's maybe now time to step into Boeing, let's take a look at it. Their symbol is BA in the aerospace and defense industry. 1.8% short on the float, 65.5% institutional owned. These valuation numbers look terrible. There's no PE ratio. Price to sales looks good, 1.3 versus 1.6. Price to book value, no book value there. It means you take away all the liabilities from the assets. There's nothing left over, like having a negative net worth. Price to cash flow is 17.3. That is better than the industry at 20.7. And Boeing does not have a PEG ratio, so you can't tell what you're paying for the future growth of the company as well. They have no earnings growth over the last year. Industry was up 10.1%. Sales did climb by 10.3% for Boeing. The industry did fall by 5%. Now, this is a number that I'm going to put a big question mark behind. It says the five-year growth rate is 252.2% versus the industry at 30.2%. I've been doing this for over 40 years. I have never seen a five-year growth rate of 252%. So there could be a misprint there, I might say, or something in the calculation. I mean, that's just as a I gotta say it's a bad number.
Well, I don't know. I'm gonna interrupt you there.
Sure.
Because right now you're looking at last year they lost a bunch of money, and this is the hard part with Boeing is that the cyclicality of the business. All of a sudden, I mean, they could go from negative. I'm looking at 2024, negative 17 cents over the next 5 years, are estimated maybe hit $15 a share on earnings.
Yeah.
And it depends on what their earnings were last year as well. I mean, I don't have the number in front of me, but it says a negative 17%. earnings in 2024 is still a 97% growth over 2023. So that means their earnings were even a bigger loss. So it's a very obscure number, right. But I don't want to say it's inaccurate.
And you know, and you're right too. And the other thing too, we have to remember with Boeing is that they build planes. And you don't build a plane in a week. It does take a long time to build those planes, sell them. I mean, I've heard many times that these contracts go for like 10 years. So yeah. You could very well be right on that. Yeah. And again, Boeing is a very unique company, but I still would be careful of it. They do not pay a dividend. I think they used to pay a dividend. I guess they cut that dividend out
during COVID. Yeah, I believe. COVID.
Yeah, never brought it back yet. Look at the balance sheet. Current ratio 1.1. That's below the industry at 1.5. No debt to equity. Why? Because they have no equity. Liabilities exceed the assets. Not a good thing. Net profit margin, negative 2.9% versus a positive 5.2. Return on equity, 12.9 versus 16.7. I'm just not feeling it yet with Boeing. I think, depending on what you say, Chase, they may have more to fall.
Yeah, and I think I pointed this out at the beginning of the year, but I forgot Boeing's high. It's all-time high. It was back in 2019. I kind of remember this because we looked at the Dow Jones, and Boeing kept lifting the Dow because the price-weighted index. In 2019, Boeing hit a price of $430.35. Today, current price, $169.82. 52-week range here, even. We'll look at the low, $167.53, and the high here, $267.54. So, I mean, again, it's well off that all-time high from about 5 years ago now. Going forward for Boeing, though, let me actually give this first. Year-to-date, the stock down about 35%. So, I mean, it's continued to have issues. We've seen whistleblower complaints. We've also seen, again, that the CEO, David Calhoun, now appears to be stepping down at the end of this year. So, I mean, there's a lot of, what I'll say, big question marks for this company. Also, too, we go out to December 2025, actually. I see estimated earnings per share of $6.19. I mean, it still gives a target sell of $102.75. I'll say it again, that the hard part with Boeing is just the complication of the cycles. And, you know, the way we value earnings, it's so hard to time it because all of a sudden they could have earnings growth of, you know, maybe in 2026, it's showing 50% earnings growth. I mean, this is such a complicated investment that I wouldn't recommend it for most people because you just can't understand the complexities that is happening with their contracts and when they're delivered and how you value those contracts. There's a lot of big question marks as an investor here, especially with all the question marks that are just now there because of the struggles this company has had.
And you mentioned those contracts. Those contracts, you really have to understand what they're doing because many of them, you want to understand what the cancellation clauses are in there because they might, oh, we got all these contracts. And then say 2026 hits, we have a pullback in the economy. People stop traveling. We'll pick on Delta Airlines. Not that I don't know if they have contracts with Boeing.
But
they
might.
What's that?
I'd assume.
Yeah, they probably do. But say, you know what? Traveling industry slowed down. It's going to cost us $10 million to cancel those contracts, but it just makes no sense to buy any planes now, so they'll cancel those contracts. And then Boeing is sitting with a plane that is either 70, 80, maybe 90% done. What do they do with it? Because if the whole world slows down, they're stuck with that. So you really, this is such a hard thing to invest into. I don't know if I would ever invest in a manufacturer of planes. And I want Boeing to do well. They're an American company. They can help, you know, our economy and so forth. But as you point out, it's a very complex thing to invest in. They had a high of 450, I think you said, or something.
It was 430, I think.
430. Now they're trading at,
169.
I mean, it's just so many variables. I would not feel comfortable investing in Boeing. And I do remember Boeing many years ago when it was at 30, I said, this is the time to buy Boeing. I believe we bought it. I was not managing as much money then, so we didn't buy a lot of it because I didn't have that many clients. But I think I sold, and unfortunately, probably compared to nowadays, but could have bought something even better. I think we sold around 60 or 70. But the numbers made sense then. Right now, the numbers make no sense.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I obviously wasn't with you when you bought it, but I still don't know if the numbers would have made sense. It's just, the business is so hard to wrap your arms around, and people generally say, oh, I'm going to buy Boeing because there's only two, you know, people there and there's a moat. It's Boeing and Airbus. But again, I mean, you look down the road, and my concern is Airbus stealing future contracts from Boeing because of the way people now view Boeing?
Right.
Is that going to hurt them? And Airbus only has so much capacity. So, yeah, you're right in that sense. But, you know, there's still a lot of potential costs. I know that Spirit AeroSystems is also a big question mark. I think that was spun out from Boeing. Now they're saying, well, maybe that should come back into Boeing. Well, with Boeing, their balance sheet is not as strong as it was pre-COVID. That could cause more complications. I mean, when I'm investing, I like to keep things simple and understandable, especially because we buy about, again, 15 to 18 different businesses. I don't need to make that overcomplicated. You can still do very well while avoiding things you don't understand. That's a big mistake people make, is they'll try and understand something that they don't understand, and it costs them money.
Yeah, and the airline industry, I guess they're still airline manufacturers, I guess we'll call them. And one thing, too, they do have defense in there as well. So I'm not sure what part of their business that is. That could maybe help them out. But if it's only 5%, it's not going to help them out. So,
and I don't understand where they sell, too, what countries. I mean, there's a lot of questions.
Yeah, a very complicated business. Well, that's a closing bell. So thank you for listening to Smart Investing Show. It is for informational purposes only and should not be used as investment advice. If you'd like to discuss in more detail your investment needs or have other investment questions, feel free to call myself, Brent Wilsey, or Chase Wilsey at 858-224-0004. Again, that's 858-224-0004. Or go to our website. A lot of great information there. SmartInvesting2000.com. Again, that's SmartInvesting2000.com. If you missed part of the show, you can also listen by podcast by going to that website, SmartInvesting2000.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week right here on the Smart Investing Show.
I did all that, and may I say,